In many ways, the happiness of having children falls into the kind of happiness that could be called fog happiness. Fog is elusive. Fog surrounds you and transforms the atmosphere. But when you try to examine it, it vanishes. Fog happiness is the kind of happiness you get from activities that, closely examined, don't really seem to bring much happiness at all. Yet somehow they do. I identified fog happiness during a party. My host was bustling around the kitchen, juggling the preparation and presentation of three major dishes he was serving to 30 people. "Are you having fun at your own party?" I asked him, when I probably should have gotten out of his way. "Not really right now," he said distractedly. "I'll have fun when it's over." "Really? When?" I wondered. "Doing the dishes? Rearranging the furniture? Carrying sticky bottles of wine to the recycling bin? Where and when exactly was the fun?" That started me thinking. Many activities that I consider enjoyable aren't much fun while they're happening, or ahead of time or afterward. Throwing a party, giving a performance, writing. When I stop to analyze my emotions during the various stages of these activities, I see procrastination, dread, anxiety, nervousness, annoyance at having to do errands and busy work, irritation, distraction, time pressure, and anticlimax. Yet these activities undoubtedly make me happy. And so it is with raising children. At any one time, the negative may swamp the positive, and I might wish I were doing something else. Nevertheless, the experience of having children gives me tremendous fog happiness. It surrounds me. I see it everywhere, despite the fact that when I zoom in on a particular moment, it can be hard to identify. Before I actually gave birth, the aspect of parenthood that intimidated me most was its irreversibility. Spouse, job, work, location, most of the big decisions in life can be reconsidered. Change might be difficult and painful, but it's possible. But a baby is different. A baby is irrevocable. Once Eliza was born, however, I never gave another thought to the irreversibility of parenthood. I sometimes miss the freedom and leisure of my pre-mommy days, but I never regret having children. Instead, I worry about being a good enough parent. My standards for parenting aren't especially high. I never fuss much about whether my daughter's food is organic or whether their rooms are tidy. But when I started my happiness project, I was uneasy about the fact that I wasn't living up to my own standard of behavior. I lost my temper. I didn't make enough time for fun. I knew I didn't appreciate enough this fleeting time in my children's lives. Though the stages of diapers and dress-up clothes and car seats seem interminable, they pass quickly. And too often, I was so focused on checking off the items of my to-do list that I forgot what really mattered. Eliza, bright-eyed and snaggle-toothed at 7 years old, is even-tempered, loving, and oddly sensible for a child. She's wildly creative and loves any kind of imaginative play or homemade project. Apart from the occasional histrionic sulking fit, she's a delight. Eleanor, at age one, with her dimples, her big blue eyes, and her never-growing hair, is a darling toddler. She has a wide emotional range. She laughs easily and she cries easily. She's friendly to everyone, fearless, very determined, and already frustrated by not being able to keep up with Eliza. My goal for April, the month dedicated to parenthood, to become more tender and playful with my two daughters. I wanted a peaceful, cheerful, even joyous atmosphere at home, and I knew that nagging and yelling weren't the way to achieve that. I had two healthy, affectionate little girls, and I wanted my actions as a parent to rise to the level of that good fortune. I wanted to stop my quick bursts of temper. I indulged in that behavior all too often, and then, because it made me feel bad, I behaved even worse. I wanted to be more lighthearted. I wanted to take steps to preserve the happy memories from this time. Eliza was old enough to grasp, dimly, that I was writing a book about happiness, but I didn't tell her that I was working on my parenting skills. As a child, I would have been shocked to learn that my parents gave any thought to how they behaved as parents. They seemed all wise, practically all powerful, without any self-doubt. Eliza, I figured, would be unnerved by the notion that I was questioning my actions as a mother. But although I didn't tell her what I was doing, April Fool's Day conveniently presented me with an opportunity to keep some of my resolutions on the very first day of the month. The night before, I'd put a bowl of Cheerios and milk in the freezer, and on the morning of April 1st, I presented it to Eliza with a spoon and watched as she tried unsuccessfully to dig in. Her puzzled look was hilarious. "April Fools," I said. "Really?" she answered, thrilled. "It's a real April Fool's joke? Great." She examined the bowl closely, then ran to show it to Jamie. She got a big kick out of the prank. The night before, I'd already gotten into bed when I realized that I'd forgotten to prepare the bowl, and I'd been tempted to drop the whole idea. I remembered my goals for April, though, and I hauled myself out of bed. When morning came, I was so happy that I'd taken the time to set up the joke. The fact is, life is more fun when I keep my resolutions. Sing in the morning. In a family, it's worth the effort to find ways to get mornings running smoothly. Because while mornings set the tone for everyone's days, they also tend to be stressful as adults try to get themselves organized while also chivying their children to get ready. From a conversation with Eliza, I got the idea of my resolution to sing in the morning. "What did you do at school today?" I'd asked her. "We talked about how our parents wake us up in the morning." "What did you say?" I prodded, with curiosity and trepidation. "With a good morning song." Why she said this, I don't know, because I'd only done that a few times in her whole life. After hearing her comment, though, I vowed to make a habit of it. This conversation also reminded me that, just as adults counsel themselves not to do anything that they wouldn't want reported in the newspaper, parents shouldn't do anything they wouldn't want featured in an essay displayed on the wall for parent night. As soon as I started, I saw that singing in the morning really had a cheering effect. I'd become a true believer of the "act the way I want to feel" commandment. By acting happy, I made myself feel happy. After singing a verse of "I've got a golden ticket," I found it easier to resist slipping into a hectoring tone. Singing in the morning reminded me to follow my ninth commandment, to lighten up. I tried to free ride off my children's laughter. Eleanor especially has always been unusually quick to laugh, even for a little kid. By pushing myself to enter into the mood, to have at least one moment of pure fun with Eliza and Eleanor each day, to laugh at Jamie's playfulness, and to take a light tone, even when I'm chastising, nagging, or fending off complaints. Easier said than done. On day 3 of my resolution, I woke up with a swollen, sore eyelid. I'm casual about most health-related matters, but because I'm so nearsighted that I'm legally blind, I take any eye problem very seriously. I'm prone to styes, but this didn't look like a stye. Singing in the morning was the farthest thing from my mind. Because Jamie was traveling on business, I couldn't leave the girls with him while I did some amateur medical diagnosis. Eliza is allowed to watch cartoons in the morning until Eleanor comes to the kitchen. I know I shouldn't let her, but I do. So I sent her to the TV and left Eleanor singing to herself in her crib while I checked internet health sites. I poked around until I assured myself that this was probably nothing serious. By then, Eleanor was roaring, "Up, up, Mama!" So I went in to rescue her. She pointed to her diaper and said, "Hurts." When I took off her diaper, I discovered an angry diaper rash. I also discovered that we had only one lone baby wipe left in the entire apartment. As I changed her diaper, using every inch of the sole wipe, Eliza, still in her favorite cherry-printed nightgown, came charging in. "It's 7:18 and I haven't even eaten breakfast," she wailed in accusation. Eliza hates to be late. In fact, she hates to be on time. She likes to be early.
"I'm supposed to be done eating and getting dressed by 7:20. We're going to be late."
Did I burst into cheering song? Did I laugh in a merry but comforting way? Did I murmur reassuringly, "Don't worry, sweetheart, we have plenty of time"? No. I snarled in my most menacing voice, "Wait a minute." She backed off and started sobbing. It took every ounce of my willpower not to keep yelling more, but after that first terrible moment, I managed to hold back. I gave Eliza a quick hug and said, "You go get dressed while I make breakfast. We still have plenty of time until school starts." Make breakfast, in this case, meant spreading crunchy peanut butter on toast. We did, in fact, have plenty of time. Because of Eliza's concern for promptness, our mornings have a sizable cushion, especially since January, when I began doing the evening tidying up. Even after the commotion, we managed to make an on-time departure. The effort to stop yelling taxed my self-control to the uttermost. But as we walked to school, I realized how much more pleasant our mornings had been than it would have been had I kept yelling. As we walked down the street, I started singing, "Oh, what a beautiful morning," until an embarrassed Eliza hushed me up. The most effective way to lighten up, but also the most difficult because a whining child sucks every particle of humor out of my head, is to make a joke. One morning when Eliza whined, "Why do I have to go to class today? I don't want to go to Taekwondo," I wanted to snap back, "You always say you don't want to go, but then you have fun," or "I don't like to hear all this grumbling." Instead, even though it wasn't easy, I sang out, "I don't want to go to Taekwondo. You're a poet and you don't know it." After a minute, I added, "I don't give a snap about going to tap." Eliza answered, "I want to stop going to hip hop." I hate every kind of bathroom humor, but she loves it. So I whispered, "I don't give a fart about going to art." She thought this was hilarious, then added, "I'd rather pass gas than go to science class." We laughed until our stomachs hurt, and she didn't mention Taekwondo again. This technique worked better than telling her to buck up, and it was certainly more fun. I hit on another rather Pollyanna-ish strategy that, to my astonishment, really worked to keep me in a sing-in-the-morning frame of mind all day long. I reframed a particular chore by deciding that I enjoyed doing it. For example, as Eleanor's birthday approached, I dreaded doing all the little errands, ordering the Baskin-Robbins ice cream cake, a Reuben family tradition, taking the girls to the party store to choose paper plates, buying presents, and making invitations for our family birthday party. I begrudged the time that I spent on it. Then I told myself, "I love making plans for Eleanor's birthday. How fun! I'll never have a baby this young again." And it really did change my attitude. I also reframed by imagining that someone else had offered to take over the task for me. Would I let someone else plan Eleanor's party? Nope. That realization also changed my attitude toward the task. A friend of mine told me that when his sons were 5 and 3 years old, they woke up at 6 every morning. On the weekends, week after week, he and his wife tried to persuade them to go back to sleep or to play quietly, with no success. So finally he gave up. He'd let his wife stay in bed, and he'd get the boys dressed and out the door. He'd stop for coffee, then the three of them would head for the park, and he'd watch them play for an hour before they returned home for breakfast. These days, his boys sleep late on the weekends, and now, my friend told me, those mornings are some of his clearest and happiest memories of that period. The morning light, the quiet park, his little boys racing across the grass. The days are long, but the years are short. Acknowledge the reality of people's feelings. As part of my research for the month, I reread, for the fourth time, the collected works of the world's greatest parenting experts, Adele Faber and Elaine Mazlish, and in particular, their two masterpieces, Siblings Without Rivalry and How to Talk So Kids Will Listen and Listen So Kids Will Talk. I discovered these books when a friend of mine mentioned that two friends of hers had the best behaved children she'd ever seen. So when I met that couple, I asked for their secret, and they swore by How to Talk So Kids Will Listen. I ordered it that night, and I became an instant follower of Faber and Mazlish. What's different about their books is that they're packed with practical advice and examples. So many parenting books belabor the arguments about the importance of the goals, as if anyone is disputing that children should be well-behaved, respectful, able to tolerate frustration, self-directed, and so on. Fine, but what do you do when your child throws a tantrum in the cereal aisle? The most important lesson from Faber and Mazlish's books is simple and as applicable to adults as to children. We should acknowledge the reality of people's feelings. In other words, don't deny feelings such as anger, irritation, fear, or reluctance. Instead, articulate the feeling and the other person's point of view. Sounds simple, right? Wrong. I had no idea how often I contradicted my children's assertions of their feelings until I tried to quit. Too often, I said things like, "You're not afraid of clowns. You can't possibly want more Legos. You never play with the ones you have. You're not hungry. You just ate." Crazily enough, I discovered just repeating what my child was saying to show that I appreciated her point of view was often enough to bring peace. Instead of saying to Eleanor, "Don't whine. You love to take a bath," I said, "You're having fun playing. You don't want to take a bath now, even though it's time." This strategy was astoundingly effective, which suggested to me that much of children's frustration comes not from being forced to do this or that, but rather from the sheer fact that they're being ignored. So what strategies could I use to help show my children that I was acknowledging their feelings? Write it down. For some reason, the simple act of writing something down makes a big impression on my children, even the preliterate Eleanor. To restore peace, it can be enough to whip out pen and paper and announce, "I'm going to write that down. Eleanor does not like to wear snow boots." Don't feel as if I have to say anything. Eliza can be a bit of a sulker. Sometimes I pull her onto my lap and cuddle her for 5 minutes, and when we get up, she's cheerful again. Don't say no or stop. Instead, I try to give information that shows that although I understand their desire, I have a reason for not granting it. "You'd like to stay, but we have to go home because Daddy forgot his keys." Studies show that 85% of adult messages to children are negative. No, stop, don't. So it's worth trying to keep that to a minimum. Instead of saying, "No, not until after lunch," I try to say, "Yes, as soon as we've finished lunch." Wave my magic wand. If I had a magic wand, I'd make it warm outside so we didn't have to wear coats. If I were Ozma, I'd make a box of Cheerios appear right now. This shows that I understand what my kids want and would accommodate them if I could. Admit that a task is difficult. Studies show that people tend to persevere longer with problems they've been told are difficult as opposed to easy. I've been doing the opposite with Eleanor. Thinking I was being encouraging, I'd say, "It's not tough to pull off your socks, just give it a try." I switched to saying things such as, "Socks can be tough to get off. Sometimes it helps to push down the back part over your ankle instead of pulling on the toe." Not long after I'd made my cheat sheet, I had a chance to put these principles to work. One Saturday, Jamie and I were talking in our bedroom when Eliza burst in crying. We knew it was real crying and not fake crying, because Eliza has a very convenient tell when she's staging her tears. If she balls up her hands and holds them to her eyes, like an actress in a melodrama, she's faking. This time, her hands were down, so we knew she was really upset. I pulled her onto my lap, and she sobbed onto my shoulder. "People always pay attention to Eleanor, but nobody ever pays attention to me." Jamie and I looked at each other with worried expressions, and Jamie gave me the look that means, "I have no idea what to do. Can you handle this one?" Just in time, I remembered my resolution: acknowledge other people's feelings. Although I knew it wasn't factually true that no one ever paid any attention to Eliza, I managed to restrain my first impulse, which was to argue, "What about the 5 games of Uno I played with you last night?" And, "You know everyone loves you just as much as Eleanor." Instead, I said, "Wow, that hurts your feelings. You feel ignored." That seemed to help. I rocked her for a few minutes in silence, then added, "Do you feel like people pay more attention to Eleanor?" "Yes," she said quietly. "So what should I do?" Instead of groping for some facile solution, I said, "That's a tough question. You, Daddy, and I will give it some serious thought." When we stood up, she threw her arms around my waist and gave me a big hug, one that felt more needy than grateful. I figured that she needed some reassurance. I put my arms around her and said, "No matter what, you know that you're our most precious, darling Eliza, and no one would ever forget about you or think that someone else is more important than you." "Come on, Eliza, let's go see if my bread dough has risen," Jamie said. "You can punch it down." She took his hand and skipped off. Experts say that denying bad feelings intensifies them. Acknowledging bad feelings allows good feelings to return. that sure seemed to be what happened with Eliza. This was a real happiness breakthrough. Not only was this approach more effective in soothing Eliza, it was far more gratifying to me to act in a loving way instead of giving in to my impulse to act in a dismissive or argumentative way. Jamie is skeptical of child-rearing techniques, and he hasn't glanced inside a book about parenting since he tossed aside What to Expect When You're Expecting after the first chapter. But even he started to use this strategy. I watched one morning when, after Eleanor threw herself, kicking and screaming, onto the floor, he picked her up and said soothingly, "You're frustrated. You don't want to wear your shoes. You want to wear your ruby slippers." And she stopped crying. Be a treasure house of happy memories. Sometimes the importance of some bit of happiness-related research or advice won't hit me when I'm reading about it. Only later do I grasp that I stumbled across something essential. One piece of wisdom that didn't resonate with me initially was the importance of keeping happy memories vivid. But as I mulled over this principle, I realized the tremendous value of mementos that help prompt positive memories. Studies show that recalling happy times helps boost happiness in the present. When people reminisce, they focus on positive memories, with the result that recalling the past amplifies the positive and minimizes the negative. However, because people remember events better when they fit with their present mood, happy people remember happy events better, and depressed people remember sad events better. Depressed people have as many nice experiences as other people. They just don't recall them as well. With this knowledge in mind, I vowed to take steps to help everyone in the family to experience happy times more vividly. Jamie loves looking at photo albums and has a secret sentimental streak for things like outgrown baby clothes, but he's not going to put in the time necessary to pull memorabilia together. If I wanted a treasure house of happy memories for my family, I needed to be the one to build it. I stopped resenting the tedious hours I spend maintaining our family photo albums. I use these albums as a family diary to capture little family jokes or funny incidents, as well as the usual round of birthday party, Thanksgiving dinner, and vacation scenes. Photos help me recall happy details that once seemed unforgettable. How Jamie used to make rice pudding all the time. How tiny our 4-pound Eliza was when she was born. And how Eleanor loved to show off her belly button. Without photographs, would we remember the fall afternoon when we wandered through Central Park with Eliza dressed as a lovely fairy, or Eleanor's ecstasy the first time we put her in a swing? Not a chance. Beyond the taking of photographs, another way to accomplish this goal was to embrace my role as the family reporter to spread family cheer. We have 2 sets of extremely engaged grandparents, and the 2 who live around the corner are as eager for information as the pair who lives in Kansas City. I made more of an effort to email informational notes with updates from the pediatrician's visit, reports on school events, or funny things that had happened. Now that I'm a parent myself, I realize how much the happiness of parents depends on the happiness of their children and grandchildren. By sending around a quick, fun email, I can give everyone in the family a lift. And also myself. Do good, feel good. As I learned in February, even Jamie likes to get emails during the day with interesting bits of family news. With this in mind, when I joined Jamie in our bedroom after tucking in Eleanor for the night, I said, "I don't think I've told you about Eleanor's new goodnight ritual. Now when I'm done rocking Eleanor, I carry her to the window and she says, 'Good night, world.'" "Does she really?" he asked in a tender voice. Without my resolution, I might never have bothered to mention it. Resolving to be a treasure house of happy memories also got me thinking about the importance of family traditions. Family traditions make occasions feel special and exciting. They mark the passage of time in a happy way. They provide a sense of anticipation, security, and continuity. Studies show that family traditions support children's social development and strengthen family cohesiveness. They provide connection and predictability, which people, especially children, crave. I know that I enjoy a holiday more when I know exactly what we're going to do and when we're going to do it. At the same time, because family traditions usually involve special decorations, special food, a special sequence of events, and participation by certain people, Most traditions, other than the tradition of ordering a pizza during the Super Bowl, involve a fair amount of trouble and are a potential source of guilt, resentment, anger, and disappointment. I was right to start my happiness project with a focus on energy. When I felt energetic, I enjoyed putting up decorations, getting out the video camera, and all the rest. When I felt low, everything seemed like a burden. Last year, I kept putting off buying a pumpkin for Halloween, and we ended up not getting one at all. Eliza and Eleanor didn't seem to mind, but I was shocked by myself. That counts as mommy malpractice in my book. But even though we didn't have a pumpkin, I did manage to keep up our family's personal Halloween tradition. Every Halloween, I take a picture of Eliza and Eleanor in their costumes, put the photo in a Halloween-themed picture frame, and add it to our Halloween photo gallery. I also give a copy to each pair of grandparents, so they have their own set. This tradition takes a fair amount of effort, but it's fun to have a set of holiday photos that we put out for just 1 week of the year. It gives a sense of family continuity, and it's an excuse to give a present to the grandparents. That's a lot of happiness bang for the buck. My desire to be a treasure house of happy memories gave rise, however, to a problem. I didn't know what to do with my children's various keepsake papers, such as those Halloween pictures. I wanted the girls to have their own copies. Where should I put them? I also wanted both girls to have a copy of their yearly birthday party invitations, the family's Valentine's cards, family wedding invitations, class photos, and so on. But where to keep all this stuff? Making little stacks and out-of-the-way cabinets and pinning papers to the bulletin board, as I'd been doing, wasn't a good long-term solution. A friend told me that she kept scrapbooks of such items for each of her kids, but my heart sank at the thought. I was barely keeping up with our family photo albums. Then my eighth commandment started flashing inside my head. Identify the problem. What was the problem? I wanted to save all these mementos for Eliza and Eleanor, but I didn't know where to put them. I wanted a convenient, inexpensive, attractive way to store them that would keep them organized without taking up too much room. Instead of moving various piles around the apartment, as I usually did when confronted with this kind of problem, I forced myself to sit and think. Convenient. Inexpensive. Attractive. Organized. Paper storage. And just like that, I thought of a solution. File boxes. I bought two the very next day. Instead of buying ugly cardboard file boxes, I splurged and bought a slightly fancier version from an upscale office supply store. The boxes were a pleasing tan color, covered with woven fabric, with proper wooden handles. I fitted out each one with a pack of hanging files. I started with Eliza. After gathering up a lot of loose memorabilia from around the apartment, I made a folder for each year of school, past and future, in which I put her birthday party invitation, a copy of the photo I took each year on the first day of school, the program from the school holiday party, some characteristic work, our family Valentine's card, a camp photo, and so on. Then I did the same with the few items I had for Eleanor. These boxes make it easy to store these mementos neatly, and they'll make great keepsakes for the girls when they're older. How fun to imagine that when they're 50 years old, they'll be able to look back at their birthday party invitations from nursery school. I was so pleased with the system that I started a box for Jamie and me, too, divided by year. As I thought about the various traditions we observed, it occurred to me that I didn't need to wait for traditions to emerge spontaneously. A new tradition may be a bit of an oxymoron, but that shouldn't stop me from inventing a tradition that I wished we had. Jamie came up with a great one, polite night. He suggested that every Sunday night, we set the table properly, enforce good manners, and have a nice meal together. Calling it polite night was my brilliant stroke. It turned out to be a very useful exercise and a lot of fun. Also, when she was little, I'd started the tradition of Eliza and her grandmother taking a weekly music class together. And when Eleanor was old enough, she started a weekly class too. Judy is deeply involved in music and theater, and having this weekly date means that grandmother and granddaughter see each other at least once a week in a context that allows Judy to impart her enthusiasm for music to the girls. Then I thought, what about their grandfather? He needed a grandchild tradition of his own, so I invented one. I proposed that a few times each year, during her vacations, Eliza would visit her grandfather at his office for lunch. He thought it was a terrific idea, and these lunches have been a great success. I have no idea how Jamie and I started this, but we have a family tradition of yelling, "Family love sandwich!" and scooping up the girls in a big tight hug, our version of a secret handshake. I wondered what traditions other people might observe, so on my blog, I asked readers for ideas from their families. Some of my favorites. When I was a kid and wanted my three younger sisters to help me clean the house, I invented a game called Cleaning Company. I had no idea there actually were such companies. I'd pretend the phone was ringing, bring, bring, with hand to ear holding an invisible receiver. "Hello, cleaning company, what's that you say? You need us to come over right now and clean your house for a party? We'll be right over, ma'am." Then I'd clap my hands together excitedly and announce to my sisters, "Sounds like another job for cleaning company." We'd pretend to pile into an imaginary car and drive over to our living room, vroom vrooming all around the house first. We were all still in elementary school, so this was pretty fun for us. Then we'd start cleaning whichever room we'd been assigned to briskly, while repeatedly singing, cleaning company, woo woo, with a raise of our hands, or feet if our hands were full, with every woo woo. Pretty crazy, huh? As a micro family, single mom of one kid, the little traditions are extra important to us because a lot of normal falls between the cracks. We have adventures regularly. It started off when my daughter was very small, and it was to glamorize our errands. Now we plan it out a bit, a map or agenda to pick the route, bring along a camera, adventure clothes, my daughter loves hats, and a snack or dish we haven't had before. When my husband and I travel away from our children, we like to bring home little presents. But instead of just handing them over when we return, I make sure to pick the presents early in the trip, then allow my children to ask for clues. Each child gets one clue per day, and they have tremendous fun coming up with the questions, coordinating with each other about who will ask what, keeping a list of the clues that have been revealed, debating amongst themselves, etc. The gift itself brings them much less fun than the guessing game. My brother has a tradition with his family. Every once in a while, they have pirate dinner. They cover the table entirely in newspapers and eat with no plates, napkins, or utensils. Just hands. He says that his kids have to follow rules and proper table etiquette all the time, so why not give them a break every now and then? I couldn't wait to suggest pirate dinner to my girls. What a great idea. Take time for projects. Traditions often involve projects. Celebrating every family birthday, sending out a family Valentine's card, decorating an elaborate gingerbread house. Actually, we make the houses out of graham crackers and tubs of Duncan Hines frosting. These things are fun, but they take time, energy, planning, and patience. Inevitably, boomerang errands are involved. Out of the urge to simplify my life, I sometimes feel reluctant to undertake ambitious family projects. But at the same time, I know that these projects are a highlight of childhood and adulthood. Once I'd resolved to take time for projects, I made a purchase that I'd been considering for a long time. I ordered a laminator. The minute it arrived, I knew it had been worth the splurge. So many possible projects. First up, Mother's Day presents for the grandmothers. Under my direction, Eliza made a list of 10 reasons I love Bunny, her nickname for my mother, and 10 reasons I love Grandma. As she dictated, I typed up her list. Then she chose a different font for each item. Playing with fonts on my computer is one of her favorite things to do. Then we printed the two lists out and let Eleanor scribble on them to add her personal touch. And then to the laminator. Suddenly, these modest pieces of paper were transformed into personalized placemats. What next? Book covers, bookmarks, cards of useful phone numbers. Inspired by the success of the laminator, I experimented with the glue gun that I'd had for years but never used. An opportunity presented itself one evening when, after Eleanor had gone to sleep, Eliza announced that she was supposed to make a scrappy cap to bring to school. "What's a scrappy cap?" I asked. "It's from Julie Andrews Edwards' book, The Last of the Really Great Wang Doodles," Eliza explained. "It's a hat that reflects our imagination." Now, in this situation, I knew perfectly well that as a parent, I should let my child take the lead while I merely helped gently and unobtrusively to guide her thinking. But instead of doing that, I leaped to my feet and said, "I know what to do. Quick, run, get a baseball cap." While she ran to get a hat, I studied the glue gun directions and plugged it in. Then I pulled down the jars of little bitty toys that I'd collected in January. "Now what?" panted Eliza as she arrived with her cap. "Dump out the stuff in the jars and see what reflects your imagination. Then we'll glue them onto this cap with a glue gun." "Oh, I love glue guns," she said. "My teacher uses them." Eliza began combing through the mounds of toys to pick her favorites. One by one, we carefully glued them onto the hat. "I didn't expect this to be so fun," Eliza said happily at one point. It took hours because she wanted to debate the merits of every single gimcrack, but that was fine. Take time for projects. Sometimes family projects pop up unexpectedly. For example, I didn't expect picking Eliza's birthday cake to turn into a project. I figured that I'd ask, as I'd asked before, chocolate or vanilla, flower decorations or princesses, and Eliza would choose. Instead, as Eliza's birthday approached, she became utterly preoccupied with her cake. The guest list, the decorations, the activities, all these considerations paled in comparison to the question of the composition and decoration of the cake. Before my happiness project, I would have pressed her to decide quickly so I could get the item crossed off my to-do list. But my research revealed that a key to happiness is squeezing out as much happiness as possible from a happy event. We've all heard of Dr. Elizabeth Kubler-Ross's 5 stages of grief: denial, anger, bargaining, depression, and acceptance. By contrast, I realized, happiness has 4 stages. To eke out the most happiness from an experience, we must anticipate it, savor it as it unfolds, express happiness, and recall a happy memory. Any single happy experience may be amplified or minimized depending on how much attention you give it. For instance, if I call my parents to tell them about a funny thing that happened in the park that day, I relive the experience in my mind as I express it. Although it's true that taking photographs sometimes makes it hard to savor a moment when it's happening, in the future, having pictures will help me recall a happy time. Eliza's birthday cake gave us plenty of opportunities to enjoy the anticipation stage. She asked me to bring home a Baskin-Robbins brochure, and we went over every word. We visited the Baskin-Robbins website, where Eliza pondered the list of ice cream flavors. We made a pilgrimage to the Baskin-Robbins store so Eliza could sample the flavors and pore over the book of possible cake decorations. At last, I thought, she'd made her decisions. Nope. "Mom," she asked a few days later, "can we go back to Baskin-Robbins to look at the cake book again?" "Eliza, we spent an hour in there already. Plus, your birthday is still a month away." "But I want to look at the book." Before the Happiness Project, I would have resisted, but now I understand that this errand isn't birthday party inefficiency, but the very fun itself. It's my 6th commandment: enjoy the process. Eliza will enjoy eating the cake for only 5 minutes, but she can have hours of enjoyment from planning the cake. In fact, in what's known as rosy prospection, anticipation of happiness is sometimes greater than the happiness actually experienced. All the more reason to revel in anticipation. "Okay," I relented. "If you want, we can stop off after school on Friday." Doing these kinds of projects showed me another way that children boost happiness. They reconnect us with sources of feeling good that we've outgrown. Left to my own devices, I wouldn't work on homemade Mother's Day gifts, pore over a Baskin-Robbins cake design, memorize "Is your mama a llama?" or go to the Central Park boat pond on a Saturday afternoon. I wouldn't watch Shrek over and over or listen to Lori Berkner's music. I wouldn't visit amusement parks or the Museum of Natural History. I wouldn't use food coloring to make rainbow yogurt surprise in a shot glass. Nevertheless, I honestly do enjoy these activities with my children. I don't just enjoy their pleasure, which I do, and that also makes me happy. I also experience my own sincere enjoyment of activities that I would otherwise never have considered. On the last day of April, as I did at the end of every month, I paused to evaluate my progress before gearing up for the next month's resolutions. Soul searching seems like an activity that should be undertaken by a woodland stream or at least in a quiet room. But this particular session of self-evaluation took place as I was riding the subway downtown. As we slowly lurched through the local stops, I asked myself, well, am I feeling any happier? Am I really? I happened to be in a blue mood that morning. If I'm honest with myself, I thought dejectedly, the fact is, I'm no different. Same old Gretchen, no better and no worse, nothing new and improved. I've been telling myself I'm happier, but I haven't really changed. Studies show that people who go to psychotherapy, or to programs to lose weight, stop smoking, start exercising, or whatever, usually believe they've changed a lot, but in fact show only a modest benefit. Apparently, after spending so much money, time, and effort, people think, wow, I must have changed for the better, even if they haven't changed that much. That's probably why I've been telling myself that I'm happier, I thought, when in fact, my project hasn't been working at all. As I got off the subway, I couldn't shake my feelings of futility and gloom. After a 2-hour meeting, I was back on the subway and headed home in a more cheerful mood, thus confirming happiness research that shows that people get a mood boost from contact with others. I resumed my argument with myself. Am I happier? This time my answer was a little different. No, but also yes. True, my fundamental nature hadn't changed. It wasn't realistic to think that I could bring about that kind of change in just 4 months or even by the end of the year. Yet, something had changed. What? Finally, I put my finger on it. In moments when I was in neutral, as when riding the subway, I was the same familiar Gretchen. The difference was that, although my nature was unchanged, I had more happiness in my life each day. My resolutions had added more sources of fun, engagement, and satisfaction, and had also eliminated some significant sources of bad feelings, such as guilt and anger. Through my actions, I was successfully pushing myself to the high end of my inborn happiness range. I could tell that my happier mood affected the household atmosphere. It's true that if mama ain't happy, ain't nobody happy. And it's also true that if daddy ain't happy, ain't nobody happy. And that you're only as happy as your least happy child. Each member of a family picks up and reflects everyone else's emotions. But of course, I could change no one's actions except my own. On a less sublime note, after evaluating my progress, I decided to give up wearing the pedometer. It had been a useful exercise, but I was getting tired of strapping it to my waistband every morning, and I'd almost dropped it in the toilet several times. The pedometer had served its purpose of helping me to evaluate and improve my walking habits, and it was time to put it into retirement. Chapter 5. May. Be serious about play. Leisure. Find more fun. Take time to be silly. Go off the path. Start a collection. May, the beginning of springtime, seemed like the right time to work on my play. That is, the activities I did in my free time because I wanted to do them, for their own sake, for my own reasons, and not for money or ambition. In an irony that didn't escape me, I prepared to work doggedly at fun and to be serious about joking around. The writer Gene Stafford scoffed, "Happy people don't need to have fun." But in fact, studies show that the absence of feeling bad isn't enough to make you happy. You must strive to find sources of feeling good. One way to feel good is to make time for play, which researchers define as an activity that's very satisfying, has no economic significance, doesn't create social harm, and doesn't necessarily lead to praise or recognition. Research shows that regularly having fun is a key factor in having a happy life. People who have fun are 20 times as likely to feel happy. I had 2 goals for the month. I wanted to have more fun, and I wanted to use my leisure to cultivate my creativity. Play wasn't merely idle time, but an opportunity to experiment with new interests and to draw closer to other people. I was very fortunate that the activities that I did for work were, for the most part, versions of the same activities that I did for fun. There were many persuasive arguments against taking busman's holidays, but I always wanted to do the same things on the weekend that I did during the week. I knew exactly what the photographer Edward Weston meant when he noted in his daybook that he'd spent the day in a holiday of work, but work which was play. As I saw in March, novelty is an important source of happiness. It's also an important element in creativity. I tend to stick to the familiar, so I wanted to push myself towards new experiences and new ideas that attracted me. I needed to take my leisure more seriously. I'd always assumed that having fun was something in my life that would flow naturally, so I didn't think about shaping it or getting the most out of it. But although having fun sounded simple, it wasn't. When I asked my blog readers about their ideas about fun, several readers responded. Making things is something that I get fun out of. I'm a great fan of crafts, but I find the fun is far increased when I'm making a present for someone. This Christmas, I have a pretty ambitious project in mind for the boyfriend, but I know he'll love it, and the challenge is giving me so much fun, as well as the anticipation that he'll appreciate it. Coming up with ideas myself is an intellectual challenge, followed by the mechanically creative challenge of realizing them, and this is a combination which I find very fulfilling and fun. Reading overseas blogs, including yours, of course, is fun to me. Every weekday morning, I read them over coffee. Since I live in the Far East, they are updated while I'm asleep. Needless to say, it helps to learn foreign language, in my case, English. But what I find fun most is to find a person who has a similar taste, way of thinking, etc., in a different culture. Books are a great source of joy and fun for me. Collecting them, reading them, looking them up on the internet. It gives me great pleasure to open a new book, whether it was previously used or fresh off the press. My weekly Latin class is a whole lot of fun for me. I have been meeting for 4 years now with a few other individuals to sight-read Latin, review grammar, and talk about whatever comes up in conversation. I fell in love with a Latin language in high school and never had the opportunity to pursue further study until now, and that has made me very, very happy. What's fun for me? Anything creative, anything. The best fun is the kind of coloring book that has a very complex picture on only one side of the page, and a new box of beautifully sharpened colored pencils. Next best, a piece of stamped material and the colored cotton floss required to complete the embroidery. Here's a tough one. I do not find it particularly fun to sit on the floor and play with my children with their toys. I love cooking with them, reading to them, talking to them, watching movies with them, going on walks with them, and taking them to age-appropriate places. My idea of a really good time is to pick up my 5-year-old from school and go out for a snack. But I don't find playing with Polly Pockets with the older one, or Little People with the younger one, particularly fun. And I feel very guilty about that at times. For me, fun is debating, tinkering, e.g. inside the guts of hardware or software, building hardware, software, reading blogs, all kinds, telling my kids stories of my youth. Seriously, I have come to the realization that I don't have fun anymore. I have got to do something about this before I become a glum, boring, sad person. Like that last commenter, I wanted to bring more fun into my life. Find more fun. When I thought about fun, I realized that, to my surprise, I didn't have a good sense of what I found fun. Only recently, I had grasped one of my most important secrets of adulthood. Just because something was fun for someone else didn't mean it was fun for me, and vice versa. There are many things that other people enjoy that I don't. I love the idea of playing chess, going to a lecture on international markets, doing crossword puzzles, getting a pedicure, eating dinner at a hot new restaurant, or having a subscription to the opera or season tickets to the Knicks. I can see exactly why other people enjoy these activities. I wish I enjoyed them, but I don't. Some blog readers experience the same tension. Over the last few years, I've started figuring out what I really find fun. I realized I had a lot of stuff and activities in my life that I didn't enjoy. These were things that others find fun, but they just weren't to me. Accepting that what others find fun won't necessarily be fun for me felt like a huge breakthrough. It's hard enough to stay in touch with what's fun for you without thinking that you should like something that others find fun. For instance, I enjoy movies, but there are cheaper activities that I enjoy much more. So I've gradually cut them out of my life. I will go occasionally with a friend, but I don't watch nearly as many as I used to, and I used to watch a couple a week. My husband posed this question to me a year or so ago. What do you find fun? And I had to think long and hard about it. Most of my pleasures are quiet and solitary. I love to be absorbed in a good book. I love to do needlework. I love to make jewelry. I've given myself permission to say that that's okay. I do love to play board games, though, especially with my children. My understanding of fun is definitely not the same as other people's. I enjoy solitary, quiet things. Even the sports I enjoy are quiet ones. Reading is fun, both books and blogs. Computer programming is fun. Diving and mountain climbing are fun. Yoga is fun. Shopping, on the other hand, which girls are supposed to enjoy, definitely is not fun. Parties are generally not fun either. I tended to overrate the fun activities that I didn't do and underrate my own inclinations. I felt like the things that other people enjoyed were more valuable or more cultured or more, well, legitimate. But now it was time to be Gretchen. I needed to acknowledge to myself what I enjoyed, not what I wished I enjoyed. If something was really fun for me, it would pass this test. I looked forward to it. I found it energizing, not draining, and I didn't feel guilty about it later. I told a friend about my quest, and she said, "Gosh, if I had something fun I wanted to do, I'd feel frustrated because I wouldn't have time for it. I don't want to add anything else to my plate." This struck me as a bleak view, but it was something I might well have said myself in the past. My happiness project had shown me that I was better off saying, "I have plenty of time to have fun." But what exactly did I find fun? What did I want to do? I couldn't think of much. Well, there was one thing. I really loved reading children's literature. I've never quite figured out what I get from children's literature that I don't get from adult literature, but there's something. The difference between novels for adults and novels for children isn't merely a matter of cover design, bookstore placement, and the age of the protagonist. It's a certain quality of atmosphere. Children's literature often deals openly with the most transcendent themes, such as the battle between good and evil and the supreme power of love. These books don't gloss over the horror and fascination of evil, but in the end, in even the most realistic novels, good triumphs. Novelists for adults don't usually write that way. Perhaps they fear being seen as sentimental or priggish or simplistic. Instead, they focus on guilt, hypocrisy, the perversion of good intentions, the cruel workings of fate, social criticism, the slipperiness of language, the inevitability of death, sexual passion, unjust accusation, and the like. These are grand literary themes. Yet I also find it enormously satisfying to see good prevail over evil, to see virtue vindicated and wrongdoing punished. I love didactic writing, whether by Tolstoy or Madeleine L'Engle. What's more, in keeping with this good versus evil worldview, children's literature often plunges a reader into a world of archetypes. Certain images have a queer power to excite the imagination, and children's literature uses them with brilliant effect. Books such as Peter Pan, The Golden Compass, and The Bluebird operate on a symbolic level and are penetrated with meanings that can't be fully worked out. Adult novels do sometimes have this atmosphere, but it's much rarer. I love to return to the world of stark good and evil, of talking animals and fulfilled prophecies. But my passionate interest in Kidlit didn't fit with my ideas of what I wished I were like. It wasn't grown up enough. I wanted to be interested in serious literature, constitutional law, the economy, art, and other adult subjects. And I am interested in these topics, but I somehow felt embarrassed by my love of J.R.R. Tolkien, E.L. Konigsberg, and Elizabeth and Wright. I repressed this side of my personality to such a degree that when one of the Harry Potter books came out, I didn't buy it for several days. I fooled even myself into thinking that I didn't care. If I was going to be serious about play, I needed to embrace the suppressed passion and have more fun with it. But how? While I was trying to figure that out, I had lunch with an acquaintance who is a polished, intimidating, well-established literary agent. We were having a, we'd like to become friends, but we haven't figured out how yet, kind of conversation, when I mentioned how much I loved Stephen King's The Stand. Now, I felt as though this was a bit of a risk, because I feared she might be the kind of person who would disdain Stephen King. I love Stephen King, and I love The Stand, she said. Then she added, but it's not as good as Harry Potter. Oh, do you like Harry Potter? I'm obsessed with Harry Potter. Eureka, I'd found a kindred spirit. We talked about nothing but Harry Potter for the rest of lunch. As we talked, it occurred to me, I knew a third person who also loved children's literature. Could we start a book group? Let me float an idea by you, I said tentatively as we were paying. Do you think you might want to start a children's literature reading group? A reading group for reading children's books? Like what? Whatever we want. The Giver, The Secret Garden, James and the Giant Peach, whatever. We could take turns meeting for dinner. Sure, that could be fun, she said enthusiastically. Fortunately, if she'd said no, I'm not sure I would have asked anyone else. I have a friend who might be interested in joining, too. So I sent out a few emails and started asking around. Once I spoke up, I was startled to discover that I already knew and liked many people who shared my passion. Because I'd never mentioned my interest, I'd never known about theirs. For our first meeting, I sent around an email inviting everyone to my apartment for dinner to discuss C.S. Lewis's The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. At the end of the email, I included a quotation from Lewis's brilliant essay on three ways of writing for children. When I was 10, I read fairy tales in secret and would have been ashamed if I had been found doing so. Now that I am 50, I read them openly. When I became a man, I put away childish things, including the fear of childishness and the desire to be very grown up. This apologia didn't mean much to anyone else in the group, because they'd never tried to squash their interest in children's literature. Why had I? No more. From our very first meeting, this group was a huge source of fun for me. I loved the people, I loved the books, I loved the discussions. I loved the fact that many of the people in the group didn't have children, so there was no question about the fact that we were reading children's literature for ourselves. I loved our kidlit tradition that the dinner's host must serve some food that tied in with the book. This started when I served Turkish Delight for dessert at the first meeting, because Turkish Delight plays a significant role in The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. At our next meeting, we drank Tokay, the wine that appears at a key moment in Philip Pullman's The Golden Compass. I was surprised to discover that Tokay was real. I'd assumed it was part of Lyra's world. For Lewis Carroll's Alice's Adventures in Wonderland, we ate mock turtle soup and treacle tart. For Blue Balliet's Chasing Vermeer, the blue M&Ms that are the signature candy eaten by Petra and Calder. For Louisa May Alcott's Little Women, Meg's Blancmange, which Joe takes to Laurie the first time they meet. At the dinner to discuss Louis Sekar's Holes, we ate Dunkin' Donuts donut holes. For the pun. Studies show that each common interest between people boosts the chances of a lasting relationship and also brings about a 2% increase in life satisfaction. This group gave me a bunch of new friends and a lift in life satisfaction that felt much higher than 2%. Also, it was fun just being part of a new group. Group membership makes people feel closer and brings a significant boost in personal confidence and happiness. By contrast, around the same time, I was elected to the Council on Foreign Relations. Interesting subject, interesting group, and so very legitimate. Which group brought me more pleasure? Which helped me form new relationships? Kidlit. I'm passionate about Winston Churchill. I'm passionate about John Kennedy. But the truth is, I'm not passionate about foreign relations. So that group didn't form as solid a basis for fun for me. So, once again, one of my resolutions led me right back to my first commandment, be Gretchen. I had to know and pursue what was truly fun for me. That was the road that led to happiness. But what else, beside the children's literature reading group, could I do for fun? I was stumped. Was I so cheerless and dull that I couldn't think of a single other thing? One thing that's both good and bad about living in New York City is the sense that I could be doing so much going to the ballet, going to an off-off-Broadway play, taking a graphic design class, shopping in Williamsburg, eating in Astoria. But I almost never do those things, so the possibilities are exciting, but also a reproach. I've been haunted for years by a public service poster I saw just one time in the subway. It was a photo of a Chinese food